Good morning, and welcome to the Friday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. The Six Big Takeaways from the UK Election by Mark Leffley. British politics has confounded experts for years, from the unexpected novelty of a five-year coalition government to the drama of the vote to leave the European Union. But the hung parliament that emerged from the June 8th snap election has produced seismic shocks across the UK. Here are six takeaways from the election. Number one, one of the greatest political collapses the UK has ever seen. When Prime Minister Theresa May called the UK election in April, she held a 21-point lead in opinion polls. One gave her a 37-point lead over Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party leader whose left-wing policies led many in the political establishment to consider him unelectable. What a difference a few weeks makes. After what has widely been considered a dismal campaign, May failed to secure an overall majority for the Conservatives. Having called the election in the hopes of building on a slim majority, her party actually lost a dozen seats. Her job as Prime Minister is only safe because dumping her now would enable the Labour Party, which exceeded expectations, to argue the case for forming a coalition. But it's clear she faces difficult times ahead. Number two, but she might have won outright if it weren't for those pesky kids. The Labour Party usually polls well among 18 to 24-year-olds. The trouble is far fewer of them make it to the ballot box than conservative-leaning elderly voters. But their enthusiasm for Jeremy Corbyn, who is 68, is remarkable. They turn up by the thousands to hear him espouse all manner of left-wing causes, from nuclear disarmament to pouring money into public services. More importantly, two-thirds of this age group said they would vote for him ahead of the election. But few thought Corbyn could translate that fervent support into votes, given this has always been such a struggle for Labour in the past. Rumor has it that 72% of 18 to 25-year-olds voted, which would be higher than the overall turnout of just under 70%, while Labour did particularly well in university towns and cities, notably Sheffield, where they toppled former Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg. Never has the divide between young and older British voters seemed so wide. Number three, the most women in Parliament ever. More than 200 of the 650 lawmakers elected yesterday were women, breaking the previous record of 191 from 2 years ago. To put that into context, only 456 women were elected between 1918 and 2015. There were 454 male lawmakers in the last parliament alone. Number four, and a slightly more diverse parliament, too. In years to come, Tan Manjeet Singh Desi will be the answer to the pub quiz question of who was the first turban-wearing Sikh lawmaker in parliament. Preet Kaur Gill joins him as the first female Sikh in the House of Commons, while the number of people of Indian origin sitting on the famous green benches is now a record 12, up from 10. Number 5. Scottish independence is off the table, for now. Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has been agitating for a second referendum on Scottish independence since the UK voted for Brexit last year. Her Scottish National Party came closer than expected to gaining independence when 45% of Scots voted to leave the three-century-old union in 2014. Sturgeon's hand was strengthened when her party devastated Labour in its traditional heartland by winning 56 out of 59 House of Commons seats in Scotland at the 2015 general election. But the SNP's spectacular rise was followed by something of a tumble yesterday, winning only 35 seats and losing their impressive leader in Westminster, Angus Robertson, and former First Minister Alex Salmond. The Conservatives secured their best result north of the border in 34 years, in evidence of a growing Scottish desire to remain part of the UK. Number 6, President Donald Trump's favorite Brit might make a political comeback. Sipping pints of ale and liberally puffing his way through packets of smokes, Nigel Farage had the everyday appeal that transformed right-wing United Kingdom Independence Party into a political force. Trump recognized a kindred spirit in Farage's populist touch, and he was the first British politician to meet the new president last year. With Brexit secured, Farage stood down as UKIP leader so he could get his life back and hopefully make some money as a Fox News commentator and talk radio host. However, he revealed overnight that he feels he has no choice but to return to the fore of British politics because the Conservative and UKIP collapses could mean the more EU-loving parties successfully secured a second referendum. Who won the Comey hearing? Russia, by Philip Elliott. Well played, Moscow. If the Russians wanted to sow chaos and distrust in American democracy, Thursday's testimony from dismissed FBI Chief James Comey helped deliver on their goal. For almost 3 hours, under the bright lights of Capitol Hill, Comey answered senators' questions about his interactions with Donald Trump, the unconventional figure whose campaign for president is the subject of an investigation about just how deeply Russian agents penetrated America's politics. In the process, Comey helped grind away at the already splintered confidence in democratic systems, including the long-held expectations that the FBI is independent of political influence, and called into question the very integrity of the nation's elections. "I took it as a direction," Comey said of Trump's suggestion that he drop his investigations. The lasting impression was that Trump had obstructed justice, the same charge that was Richard Nixon's downfall. Comey didn't offer a legal conclusion, but clearly laid out a case that Special Counsel Robert Mueller could build criminal charges against the president. Comey also said he shared his contemporaneous notes from his sessions with Trump with Mueller. Repeatedly, Comey spoke to his firing, which in itself was previously unthinkable. Comey also seemed intent on settling a score with the president, who, in the FBI chief's telling, sought to develop an "I scratch your back, you vindicate my national security advisor" situation. "I'm hopelessly biased," Comey said, indicating he lost his job and the FBI its chief because the president felt threatened by an investigation circling him. That investigation is ongoing even after Comey's ouster. Trump's attempt to shut it down by firing the FBI chief only made it worse, in fact. "The work is going to go on as before," Comey said. Now he is out of government and free to speak his mind, especially about his highly unusual one-on-one conversations with the president. "Those were lies, plain and simple," Comey said of the president's rationale for firing him. Russia clearly came out ahead after the session. The integrity of America's justice agencies was under fire. An ousted FBI chief, the nation's top cop, suggested the President of the United States was a serial liar who has only a passing relationship with the truth. The same official said he asked a friend at Columbia University to leak memos to reporters already facing low poll numbers. The president's legal standing has never been less secure, which could spook Wall Street. Concern about improper influence of political appointees was back as a bogeyman, as were Bill and Hillary Clinton. The fact Russia put its thumb on America's elections and got away with it screamed for answers. And at the White House, a spokeswoman was left to make the remarkable claim that the president is not a liar. None of this is normal or helpful for an electorate with fleeting confidence in its democratic systems, which is precisely why Russia started down this path. The United States' idealized place in the global pecking order is secured, in theory, because of its commitment to democracy. Fair elections, transparent government, accountable leaders, a government's sovereignty. Each is now under assault, either through Russian meddling or the president ushered to power by it. Russia is looking to benefit from this zero-sum fight, and it's clear its former KGB agent president has ideas. From the start, Comey made it clear he had zero doubts Russia attempted to interfere with the election of 2016. He repeatedly indicated he had plenty of evidence that he couldn't share while reporters were in the room. "That's a question I don't think I should answer in an open setting," Comey said time and again. Lawmakers rushed from the open to the public session to the closed one, hoping to find more clarity about just what the feds have uncovered about the president and those around him. For their part, Trump's loyalists and lawyers spun the day as a win for the president. They argued that Comey repeatedly told the president he wasn't under investigation. What they missed, though, is that the FBI investigates crimes, not criminals. They start with a situation and move to individuals once they understand the facts. What Comey could say, however, left a rather dim view of a president who apparently attempted to pressure his FBI chief to shut down investigations into Russia's influence operations in 2015 and 2016. The narrative read like a political thriller, but executed with Veep-like competence. "There clearly remain a lot of questions," said Senator Mark Warner, the top Democrat on the intelligence panel. "We're going to get to the bottom of this." But then what? Justice, as Americans expected, would only grate at democratic institutions if Comey's allegations are proved. And that gives Russia yet another victory in its new Cold War with the United States.
"The UK election has produced no clear winner," by Tara John. The British political landscape was clouded by uncertainty once again on Friday morning, as no single party won an overall parliamentary majority in the June 8th snap election, leaving the country rudderless with only days to go before negotiations begin over withdrawal from the European Union. The Conservative Party of British Prime Minister Theresa May won the most seats by the slimmest of margins, but lost its majority to form an effective government, an enormous blow for the Prime Minister, who called the election in order to consolidate power. With all but three of the seats declared, the Conservatives, or Tories, had taken 316 seats, which means voters have elected their second hung parliament in less than a decade. The Conservatives will now have to turn to other parties to cobble together a workable majority, most likely with the Democratic Unionist Party, DUP, of Northern Ireland, which won 10 seats. The result calls into question May's future as leader of the party. Clearly, if she's got a worse result than 2 years ago and is almost unable to form a government, then I doubt she will survive in the long term as Conservative Party leader, former Conservative Chancellor George Osborne told the British press, Financial Times reports. The British media reported she had no intention of resigning, but was working to form a minority party. The result is being billed as one of the biggest political upsets in the country's history, with the Labour Party of far-left Jeremy Corbyn defying expectations and projected to gain 265 seats in Parliament. Corbyn suggested he too would be ready to form a government. "I think it's pretty clear who won this election," he told the BBC on Friday morning. "We're ready to serve the people who have given their trust to us." The hung parliament could result in a phase of political instability for Britain. Some analysts are speculating a second general election, which would further destabilize upcoming Brexit negotiations that are expected to start on June 19th. Back in April, the Prime Minister called the general election as polls pointed to a landslide result for her party. The gamble backfired. On Friday morning, it became clear the Tories lost seats in the south of the country while failing to break into Labour's heartlands up north. The huge setback dashes May's hopes to strengthen her hand in the upcoming Brexit negotiations, with the EU Brexit Secretary David Davis suggesting to Sky News that the lost majority could amount to the Tories losing their mandate for a hard Brit exit, where the country would leave both the EU customs and single market. Arlene Foster, leader of the DUP, appeared to confirm as such when asked about joining a possible coalition government with the Tories. "No one wants to see a hard Brexit. What we want to see is a workable plan to leave the European Union. That's what the national vote was about, and therefore we need to get on with that. Brexit presents a thorny challenge to Northern Ireland, which shares a land border with the Republic of Ireland, which will remain in the EU. Brexit talks with EU leaders were due to begin in 10 days' time. Still, the referendum was not the main issue informing Thursday's vote. Labour made a really positive offer to an electorate who is fed up with austerity, that has doubts about globalization and the neoliberal economic models we have had for so long," Tim Bale, professor of politics at Queen Mary University of London, tells Time. The most significant defeats of the night included Conservative Minister Ben Gummer and the Liberal Democrats' Nick Clegg, the former Deputy Prime Minister, who both lost their seats to Labour challengers. The pound tumbled by close to 2% after an initial BBC exit poll, which predicted a hung parliament.
These glasses helped stop my end-of-day headaches, by Alex Fitzpatrick. Compared to working in construction, in an emergency room, or as a firefighter, there's almost nothing physically demanding about sitting in front of a computer for 8-plus hours a day. But that doesn't mean office jobs don't come with real health risks of their own. For me, it's headaches. I can't remember the last time I didn't pound a couple of ibuprofen the minute I got home from work. Until, that is, I tried Pixel Eyewear. These glasses, about $70 and available in multiple styles, are designed to reduce eye strain when you're staring at a computer for long periods of time. They reflect blue light, add contrast, and reduce glare. Wearing them adds a bit of a yellow tint to your world, but you get over it pretty quickly. They're available as reading glasses, but not yet with prescription lenses. And the best part, after trying them for a couple of weeks, I noticed I was going home headache-free. Of course, health experts will tell you to take frequent breaks from your screens, look at things that are far away, and get up from your desk to stretch your legs a bunch. That's all good advice, but there are days when that's just not practical, and on those days, the Pixel glasses are great. Another potential solution? Try installing F-Lux, a software program that cuts down on the amount of blue light your monitor is emitting. It takes a little getting used to, but I've been a fan for years, and I'll never go back.
Bringing Cassini's Saturn photos to life. Each moving cinemagraph is built from a single image, by Jeffrey Kluger. The Cassini spacecraft was not sent out to Saturn to create art. It was sent there to do science. But when the science you're conducting involves a planet like Saturn, with its elegant rings and flock of 62 moons, the art is inevitable. If there's any limitation to the loveliness Cassini has sent home, it's that the images are static, snapshots from the field as opposed to moving pictures. But time worked with cinematographic artist Armand Dijix to address that. To animate Cassini's pictures, Dijix works with image distortion software that allows him to analyze the motion frozen by the camera and then fill in what likely happened next. That takes more than an understanding of imagery. It also requires an understanding of physics so that the behavior of a cloud or a ring or an orbiting moon is true to the way things work in the physical world. In one of his images, light from the sun, which was eclipsed by Saturn, streams from behind the backlit planet. The tiny dot at lower right is Earth, 746 million miles away. Dijix zooms in by incorporating the iconic blue marble image of Earth taken by the Apollo 17 crew in 1972. Saturn can be stormy, which is no surprise since storms happen in a planet's atmosphere, and Saturn is little but atmosphere. Animating a storm system in Saturn's northern hemisphere was not easy because the planet's rotation plays a big role. Saturn turns speedily on its axis, its day lasting less than 11 hours compared to our 24. On a solid planet like Earth, that day is exactly the same length everywhere. On a gas giant, the atmosphere can drag behind the spin at different rates depending on latitude. The result? A day at Saturn's equator lasts 10 hours and 14 minutes. Above and below the equator, it's 25 minutes longer, all of which is reflected here. In this image, the seemingly razor-sharp rings are seen edge-on. Geometry from Chaos. One of Saturn's oddest features is the hexagonal storm at its north pole. The overall system is formed by a six-sided jet stream surrounding a central hurricane, one that's about 50 times larger than even the worst hurricanes on Earth. Cassini captured this picture from a distance of about 261,000 miles. To animate it, Dijix once again had to take into consideration the changing rates at which the atmosphere rotates, not to mention the rotation of the hurricane itself. Baby Shepherd. Saturn's rings may look paper-thin when seen edge-on, but from overhead or underneath, they reveal themselves as the complex series of belts they are. Here, Saturn's tiny moon Pan is seen orbiting in a space in the rings known as the Encke Gap. The little satellite, which measures just 17 miles across, zips around Saturn once every 13.8 hours. Its small size means that its gravity is exceedingly weak, but it's still strong enough to keep the 200-mile gap open. The speeding snowball. The icy moon Enceladus looks like nothing at all next to the vast bulk of Saturn. It measures just 314 miles across, compared to Saturn's 72,367 miles. This image was captured from a distance of 930,000 miles. For all its apparent inconsequence, however, Enceladus has long intrigued scientists. Its surface is bright white and highly reflective. Its composition, including water ice, carbon dioxide, salts, and organic compounds, suggests that the moon might, just might, be hospitable to life. Bursts of life? The case for life on Enceladus got stronger when Cassini spotted what were unmistakably geysers erupting from its south pole. The plumes burst from what astronomers have dubbed the Tiger Stripes, a series of roughly parallel cracks in the ice. Both the stripes and the eruption suggest that Enceladus harbors a deep ocean of salty water, kept warm and surging thanks to gravitational flexing by Saturn. It is in relatively warm, salty oceans that life got its first foothold on Earth. Some people make songs. Jack Antonoff prays for them. By Sam Lansky. When Bleachers frontman Jack Antonoff arrives in your city on his upcoming tour, he'll have something unique in tow, his childhood bedroom, painstakingly reconstructed in the form of a traveling art installation. It makes sense since Antonoff is fascinated with the idea of baggage, mostly the emotional kind. "We all have this stuff we carry around in an invisible suitcase," he says. "You can't keep it all, because if you keep it all, you can't move forward. But you can't let it go, because if you let it all go, you're not yourself. The great balancing act of life is, what do I keep in here?" Gone Now, his new album Out Now, offers answers. The music is deeply personal and more than a little bonkers, pop music without guardrails. Antonoff calls it the sound of a person going crazy alone in a room. For the 33-year-old singer-songwriter who's been in band since his high school days in New Jersey, it's the opportunity to make music unfettered by anyone else's creative impulses. On a tour stop in Seattle, we meet for dinner and talk about how he made this new record, Mental Illness in Pop Culture, and the cost of being a creative person. Time. You're still based in New York, even though there's been an exodus of artists to Los Angeles. Do you prefer it? I love it more now that everyone left. It's a better place to create than ever. I just don't think it's good to be around too much creative energy other than your own. That's a weird fable of work. You don't want to be in a crazy creative space. At least for me, any time I've been in hotbeds of creativity, I got excited about something that wasn't coming from me. Sometimes when I look at production credits on a song, there are 12 writers on it. I don't feel like your name is often one of 12. I'm not super social that way. That's not my opinion of what makes it good or bad. That's just what makes me good or bad. That's always how I've made my own records, alone. So if I do a record with someone else, it's much more comfortable to have them come into my space than entering some bloated environment with lots of people and opinions. It's the difference between crafting something versus an assembly line. There's glory in a big sports car, but there's also glory in buying a button on Etsy. It's not saying one or the other is better. But it also means that work isn't happening by committee. What you put out seems like it's exactly what you intended to create. Well, that's the goal. I'm not trying to write a perfect record. I'm just trying to nail a moment in time. Is this an album about trying to decide what to let go of and what to keep? It's this big package, and then you tie a little bow on top, and the package is my whole life, and every album is a giant funnel. The first Bleachers album was more like a diary. It read like, here's what happened, here's when it happened, here's why it happened, and here's what it did to me. It was so literal because I made it in headphones in a computer. This album has been more about where do you go from here? One thing I started looking at a lot on this album is how everyone has an end of innocence moment. For me, I was 18, it was 9/11, my sister died, my cousin was killed in the war, and I had life before that and life after. Life before that was, that shit happens to other people. Life after was, everything happens to me. You start getting on airplanes and saying to yourself, it's going to go down. That's the ultimate feeling of becoming an adult. You let go of the belief that it doesn't happen to you. So how do you move forward? How do you exist in a relationship? How do you be 33 and not just a piece of shit who tours? I don't want only that. To me, this album is also about the difficulty of being a person in the world who feels things deeply, which feels like a conversation that's very timely. Why do you think that dialogue is playing out more in the public now? Well, first, it's science, just the literal science of anxiety and mental illness. You think in 20 years someone's going to be like, oh, there's dirt on my spoon, I'm having a panic attack. I think that's a serious thing. Even the lingo, you're such a psychopath. I'm sorry, I'm such a schizo. There are things in society that we don't have tolerance for. We don't have tolerance for single people. We don't have tolerance for mental illness. And we don't have tolerance for people with no God. At this moment, I'm two of those people. I've been three of those people. Mental illness. We just started having that conversation. My grandparents got out of Poland right before the Holocaust and came here, and the only thing that mattered was surviving. Then my parents were more like, you gotta go to work so you can have a good life. My generation was the first time we started saying, Jack can't focus at school. What's wrong with him? Maybe he's not a loser. Maybe we send him to a therapist and don't tell him to be a tough guy. I see kids now and I'm almost envious of them because there's this conversation. You wake up one day and you don't want to get out of bed? Well, maybe you're not a loser. Maybe you're not lazy. Maybe you're depressed. A lot of those things I forgave myself for later in life. Is healing something that you think about? I don't think about that at all. I don't know what a version of healing would be once you've carried all these things forever. I don't want to lose those things. I don't want them to heal or change or get better. I want to understand them. Having panic attacks or disassociating, then I want to heal. So there's a scale where it's like, can you leave the house? Can you connect with people? Can you care for yourself right? If you can't do those things, you have to heal. But everything else, I think, is an attempt to understand. I want to understand why I feel certain ways. I want to understand why I can't do certain things and can do other things. I want to get myself the way I get other things. But would you be as creative if you didn't have parts of you that were underdeveloped? I agree with you, but after a time, it just gets tiring. I've never had a romantic connection to being a fucked up artist. You start to miss out on things. Things got hard making this record. How so? You only have so much heart and soul to spread around, and if you put it all somewhere, something else has to fall out of the suitcase. Writing is such a prisoner's deal. You can't just do it. You have to wait around for it. You have to put yourself in a space where it can happen. That space doesn't give a shit if so-and-so's wedding is that night. I don't think that's cool. I want to be there. Those are the things that you remember. Remember when we went to the diner that one night and talked? Remember this person's wedding? You start to consider those things. You want to have all of them. Where do you fall now on that spectrum? Well, the work is fun, but I felt bogged down by hearing things and trying to get them out. You know, I pray to hear things. I literally pray for songs. You can't make them. You can't fucking make them. You can make a song, but nobody would care about it. It wouldn't have heart and soul. Why do you hear one song and it defines what's inside you, and you hear another song and it means nothing to you? You can't define it, right? So I sit around and literally pray for those words and sounds, and when they come, it's like your baby is being born. If you're watching your baby come out of someone, you wouldn't be like, oh, it's Jimmy's work party, I gotta go. But at some point, you gotta return to normalcy. So what happens if that happens 12 times a year? I don't write a lot of songs. On this album, there isn't one more song that I wrote. I never understood or had the capacity to write many songs and choose. How long did it take you to finish? 2 years. I've always been that way. I need work. I always thought everything you should do should be the best thing you've ever done. 9 Foods Americans Don't Eat Much Anymore and Why We Should Start Again by Tim Cibula. Decades of devotion to convenient, mass-distributed processed foods turned the national larder generic and bland. But by embracing local food sources, slow food tenets, and ecologically sound methods, we're rediscovering deliciousness from back in the day. Here's a taste of 9 new old trends. Number 1, bitter flavors. There's a bitter flavor boom underway, thanks in part to bitters, the alcohol-based botanical concoctions, and a gorgeous riot of purple and green speckled chicories. Use them to add color and crunch to gratins and sautés. Number 2, heirloom apples. Johnny Appleseed didn't just plant red delicious trees. Our continent has hosted more than 15,000 apple varieties over its history. Today's forward-thinking growers have restocked their farms with Nodheads, Granite Beauties, Pitmaston Pineapples, and hundreds of other varieties. Find them in the late summer, fall, and winter at your farmers' markets. Number 3, next-level breads. Tangy, chewy sourdoughs mixed with whole grains, leavened with wild yeast, and left to ferment represent ancient baking tradition, though we're just starting to appreciate it again now, thanks to small artisanal bakeries sprouting like wheat berries nationwide. Look for micrograin mills suited for home kitchens and cricket flour as interest grows in baking with fresh-milled whole grains. Number 4, ancient grains. In the beginning, there was amaranth, black barley, farro, and spelt, too. Many years later, we worshipped corn, rice, and white flour. Now, the health benefits and the new world of the oldest whole grains have made us disciples once again. Number 5, heritage meats. Breeders raising old-line animals, Ossabaw and Berkshire pigs, White Park cattle, Blue Andalusian chickens, Bourbon red turkeys, to name but a few, bring to market incredibly flavorful protein, a stark contrast to the lean hybrid commodity meats in supermarkets. Number 6, charcuterie and salumi. Once exclusive to bistros and trattorias, house-cured meats have become a passion project for many American chefs. The movement falls directly in line with farm-to-table and nose-to-tail principles the food world has espoused for years now. Number 7, bycatch and oily fish. Savvy restaurants now offer species once discarded as trash fish, touting their tastes and eco-friendly pedigrees. The crusade is also a net gain for previously unfashionable oily fish loaded with omega-3s, like sardines, anchovies, mullet, and mackerel. Number 8, fermented foods. Snappy, slightly effervescent Korean kimchi, unpasteurized sauerkraut, kefir, and kombucha are among the most popular items laced with good gut bacteria, proving healthy food can and should be the boldest tasting, most delicious stuff you eat. Number 9, aquaculture. After a century-long lull, oyster beds are repopulating our coastlines as bivalves come back into vogue. Look for more sustainably farmed fin fish like catfish and trout and ocean farms of seaweed to help replace the demand for declining stocks of wild fish. Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the Daily Edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.